Last season, I talked about how narrative, as a construct, can represent either the full story of an organization or an intervention into it. But unfortunately, the organization's own narrative is not the only version of the story. In a competitive world, other actors use counter-narratives against the organization, alternative stories that are often adversarial, intended to harm the organization's reputation or tarnish its images. Popular communication literature plays this image up a lot. But is it accurate? Are all counter-narratives adversarial? Or are they only used by our enemies? My name is Tom Galvin, and these are my reflections on management. I want to start by just defining the term counter-narrative from my perspective, because counter-narratives are used a lot in discussions of societal situations. So counter-narratives are defined as narratives that exist primarily to refute dominant narratives. And when we're talking about a dominant narrative, we're talking about something that, a story that drives society. And I think a good example of it is masculinity or the patriarchal society. The way to look at it is that the dominant narrative is favors the strong man and assigns particular responsibilities or roles to according to gender. And obviously, it marginalizes potentially the female members of society. And so then the counter narrative to that is one that suggests either equality or the opposite, basically refuting the validity or the value of a masculine or a male-dominated society and presenting the alternative, which is one that is equitable. Those are basically societal. What I do in my work in communication is I apply those to organizations, and there's a lot of support for this because others have used counter-narratives as stories that refute the dominant narrative of the organization. And in the episode that I did last season, the dominant narrative is essentially the organization's identity and its projected image. Albert M. Wetton and Joy Schutz and Corley are where I drew a lot of that from. So the organization, based on who the organization sees that it is and what it presents as an image, which is typically favorable to suggest that, you know, buy our products and services and all that sort of thing, the counter narratives are used by others to suggest that claims of that organization are wrong, misleading, whatever you want to say. Okay, so if we take it from an adversarial point of view, that's what a counter-narrative is. It's a adversarial negative story. Now, the question that I raise is that really the only kind of counter-narrative? So what I want to do is I want to present a discussion about counter-narratives using a case study that I've written up, and it's available, and I'll have links to it from my website. So this is about the creation of the U.S. Africa Command back in the 2006 through 2009 timeframe. Okay, just some background. United States Africa Command is a military organization. And what the military does, the U.S. military does, other nations with global security interests do this to varying degrees. But the Department of Defense has responsibilities for military-to-military exchanges and programs, not just within the U.S. military, but also with partners, allies, coalitions. We help with building the security capacity of other nations. We have partnerships. And in order to manage relationships that are essentially around the world, the Department of Defense divides these responsibilities to a series of organizations known as Geographic Combatant Commands. And we have one that's focused on Europe and Eurasia. That's the U.S. European Command. We have one that's focused in the Asia-Pacific region, which is U.S. Indo-PACOM, Indo-Pacific Command. What we do is we have a command plan that basically designates how the regions are drawn. And so in 2006 timeframe, there was a decision made to create a new command focused on Africa. Previously, there were three commands that shared responsibilities in Africa. European Command had a part, Indo-PACOM, then it was known as simply PACOM. Pacific Command had a part. And U.S. Central Command, who is Middle East, had a part. They were responsible for the Horn of Africa region. So if you were an African nation, then you had, depending on which part of Africa you were in, determined which command you were going to be partnering with. The decision was made to consolidate all of that, and it was a simple redrawing of the boundaries. At least, that's what the Department of Defense thought. Now, this was 2006, which was perhaps a challenging time for the United States, especially in terms of its activities in Iraq and Afghanistan, and some, you know, negative perceptions of the United States that were propping up in various parts of the world. The decision, when it was made public that the United States was going to create this command, which was, again, just a redistricting of the boundaries, if you will, it launched some criticism that was suggesting that this was a much more, shall we say, nefarious action. The stories that emerged, in my review of this situation, came to basically clustered around some particular themes. And each theme I found had a narrative structure to it. It had a story from which there was any number of messages being aimed at the United States Africa Command to suggest that it should not be formed. So one of them was the idea that the United States is neo-colonizing Africa. It was going to be a new neo-colonial power. The source of this story is pretty simple. Africa, of course, has a rather deep colonial history. It's not favorably remembered by most Africans, obviously. Independence was hard-earned, and there was a lot of fear that the decision for the United States to put renewed interest in Africa was just another attempt to take away African sovereignty, African freedom. This was coming from a number of African parties, and many were represented in the United States, and there were protests, and there were a lot of statements made that were suggesting that this nefarious idea was what the United States was actually doing, despite the public statements of why the United States was building the command. So that was one counter narrative. Another counter narrative was also coming from the largely African population, but it was aimed a little bit differently. And this was one that was suggesting that Africans just simply distrusted militaries in general. And it's not hard to understand why, because this was even cited in a lot of the statements that were coming. It had to do with the post-independence experience of the formation of new African nations, which unfortunately included a number of episodes of brutality by militaries used to support autocratic regimes, significant numbers of military coups against, in some cases, legitimate democratic activities. And even in the beginnings, we were getting stories from African women who were claiming to being victimized and brutalized by the militaries, and they were equating their experience with African militaries to, well, the United States is this more powerful military, they're going to come in and do the same thing. And then the third one was actually within the U.S. government, and this was sort of a divide between the Department of Defense and the Department of State. This was basically that the United States had been militarizing its foreign policy and that the creation of African Command was just another episode of that. Around that time, this was a time when interagency relations were a bit strained. That's very well documented. this, it sort of carried over to the idea that, well, the United States Department of Defense is going to take the lead in creating this command. But all it's going to do is going to continue to push aside what the ambassadors, who are the rightly, the proper presidential representatives to African nations, it's going to cut into their authorities, cut into what it is they're going to do. And there were some very strong, especially from retired ambassadors who were writing some very strong statements, basically saying that this was a really terrible idea to create this command. So these were three very different counter-narratives. They weren't the only three that I found, but for present purposes, I'm going to stick with these three. And again, they all had a narrative structure. There was essentially an underlying decision to say that, you know, if we do this command, or if we create this organization, the following will happen. If we don't create it, then this, you know, some other more desirable future will take place. Or the status quo will be, the preferable status quo will be maintained. And so the idea, you know, the messaging was essentially trying to put people at the point of decision to say, okay, status quo, or we mess things up. I mean, it's basically was painted in that kind of a way. And the, you know, the strength, the tone, of course, from some was very, very negative. And there was no convincing some parties that, that the creation of the command was a good idea. This kind of showed, you know, in a way, you know, the adversarial, certainly a couple of them were very adversarial in nature. And so we kind of see how those could serve as counter narratives. But when I analyzed these three, I found that there's actually some very important differences in the way in which they translated into messages and the way that they, you know, they were perceived. I'm going to start with the militarizing of foreign policy. In a lot of ways, I found that the messages were actually fairly benign. They were constructive. Essentially, it was a rational dispute between the Department of Defense and the members of the current or former members of Department of State who had reservations about the creation of the command. The Department of State, in, you know, in many other ways, was a friendly force. They were partnering with the Department of Defense in many other venues. This was just simply a point of disagreement, but it was still a counter-narrative and a very powerful one. One that the organization or its members were using to try to influence a decision being made by a different organization. So that one was sort of rational. It was sort of constructive. And it wasn't by an adversary. It was by, you know, in a way, it was by a friend. It was by a partner. And then I found some of the same things in the discussion about neocolonization. Whereas in some cases, you know, there were adversarial messages coming from Africans, other audiences in Africa who were perhaps against the command were really more against it because they were not sure what it was, weren't really fully informed. Their criticisms were actually statements in the form of questions. Or questions in the form of statements, I should say. So there was a rationality to those as well. And again, these were not necessarily adversaries. They were sitting on the fence. They weren't sure. They were ambivalent. So again, talking about counter narratives being used by those who are not adversaries. Then, of course, you know, we get into the ones that really were adversarial, and they were very emotional. And the thing that that struck me about comparing those types of audiences against the ones that were using more rational criticisms. The ones that were a bit more rational were a little bit easier to convince with rational responses. Whereas the ones that were emotional, no matter what you said, they basically either didn't respond in any way or didn't even acknowledge your response, or they simply chose a different angle. Instead of targeting this aspect of the organization, they would target that aspect of the organization. It was sort of like talking to a wall. Even though the messages themselves were, you know, picking and poking at different aspects of the statements being made by the organization, the fact is they were simply repudiating the existence of the organization. There was no satisfying them. There was no room for any sort of real discussion. It wasn't a discussion. It was just intentional passing, passing by each other. What I found is that in subsequent situations where I'm evaluating the communications going on between two parties, I found that a very striking pattern, this idea of repudiation. So that was kind of like the opposite end of the rational spectrum. And then there was the third one, which is the Africans distrusting militaries. Well, why would they issue that? Why would they use that sort of a counter-narrative aimed at U.S. Africa Command if the real target of their counter-narrative was their own militaries? Well, the answer to that is pretty simple, and it's another pattern that I saw routinely. Africa Command was a proxy. They were a straw man. They were a symbol of a complaint or a counter-narrative, but they weren't the actual target of the counter-narrative itself. And in a similar way, U.S. Africa Command was also a proxy for in the neo-colonization piece, because the actual target was the United States, not specifically this command. The command was criticized because it represented the United States. And so what you had was the third form of counter-narrative, a representational one or a proxy. That's in essence what I came up with, or what I saw. That if you're talking about counter-narratives, you're really talking about three different varieties of story. The rational ones, in which you're really poking a specific discrepant claim against the organization's identity. You're saying that this particular thing is wrong. Correct this one and the counter-narrative goes away. We stop criticizing. Okay, so that's sort of like one type. Second type is the repudiation of existence. To basically say that we don't care what you say. We hate you because you're here. You are an irritant to us because you exist. And no matter what you say, we're going to shift targets. We're going to shift our messaging. We're going to shift, we're going to basically avoid any sort of engagement with you, because engaging with you in a rational sense does not serve our counter narrative. And then the third one is the representational one, which is essentially that the organization is used as a proxy for something else, for a counter narrative that's really directed elsewhere. It is a useful, at least I want to propose those three as kind of like a start, as a way of categorizing counter narratives differently. Because I think, as I'll talk about in a future episode, I think the end result is that you have to respond to these types of counter narratives differently. You can't defend the organization against a rational counter narrative the same way that you can against a repudiation one. It won't work. So in the future episode, I'll talk a little bit about what are different defensive strategies. What are ways in which we can counter the counter narrative? I hope you'll stay tuned for that episode. It's coming later this season. And that's all for now. The views expressed are my own and do not necessarily reflect those of the United States Army War College, the United States Army, or the Department of Defense. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.